Hello, and thank you for listening to the History of World War II podcast, episode 414, In the Lap of the Gods. Last time, we watched as the straggling merchant ships, like the tanker Ohio and cargo ship Almeria Likes, tangled with the Italian E-boats, and one victim was the light cruiser HMS Manchester. So perhaps Mussolini would get away with recalling Admiral De Zaro's attack fleet. After all, if all these supply ships up pedestal were sent to the bottom of the Mediterranean, did it really matter how they got there? The Axis higher-ups would just have to hope for the best, as did the Allied elite, not to mention the struggling people of Malta. But going back in time a few hours, as the first ships of pedestal entered the Narrows, the Italian sub Alaghi, commanded by Captain Puccini, spotted the HMS Manchester leading some of the still-assembling merchant ships, but had to keep his distance at first, as the Allied ships were subjected to German air attacks. So Puccini matched their course and speed and waited his turn. And later, when the ships got closer to his position, he had moved ahead of them, Puccini let loose four torpedoes at the cruiser Kenya, now a part of the escort. But at that very same moment, the Alaghi was spotted by two lookouts, one of the Port Chalmers and one on Kenya's bridge. But it was the latter that saved the cruiser. Turning hard, three of Puccini's four torpedoes missed. Had they struck, the Kenya would have been doomed. As it was, the one torpedo that hit struck in the front at the forefoot, where the forward lower part of the keel meets the hull. Problem was, she had been going 14 knots when struck, so the flooding up front quickly took place, which included all of the forward compartments. Further, her echo-sounding equipment was now damaged. This happened just after 9 a.m., but the Kenya could still travel at convoy speed. So, after assessing the damage, she sped up to catch up to the Manchester. Later, the Ashanti and Pathfinder joined them. The Pathfinder's lead officer, Commander Edward A. Gibbs, told Admiral Burrow on the Ashanti that the bulk of the remaining merchant ships were behind them and, as far as he knew, unprotected, which is when Burrow sent the Pathfinder back to them to round them up. As for the sub Alaghi and her leader Puccini, they were able to escape and report to home that a cruiser and merchant ship had been struck, which was half true. No supply ship was damaged during this attack. As for the supply ships, they were still reassembling or traveling in small groups. Like the supply ship Warangi, she had made contact with the Almeria Likes and they joined up, later to be joined by Warangi's sister ship, the Wayne Marama. By 10:20 p.m., they were in a line and heading southeast. It may be remembered that the tanker Ohio had been struck by Stuka bombs, but had dealt with the fires as best as her crew could. But between that experience and seeing what was left of the Clan Ferguson still on fire, the men of Ohio just wanted this to be over, provided they did not end up like the Ferguson. In trying to make sure that didn't happen, the destroyer Ledbury, escorting and leading the Ohio, steered clear of the flames on the sea's surface, as many of the tanker's compartments had been ripped open and oil was still leaking out. But so far, the tanker's luck held. Actually, it was better than any of her crew could have guessed, because at 11:48 p.m., just before the Ledbury and Ohio were to pass the position of the Italian sub Bronzo, she had put a finishing torpedo into the burning but still drifting Clan Ferguson and then left the area. Had the Ohio come by before this moment, Captain Buldrini would have chosen the still moving Ohio to the clearly distressed Ferguson. By 11:54 p.m., August 13th, the word formation would have been a stretch for the ships of pedestal. The minesweeping destroyers were in the lead, having just rounded Cape Bon. Behind them were the leading groups of warships, and just behind them were a few of the remaining merchant ships, the Glenorchy, Almeria Likes, and Warangi. The other supply ships were behind this group, being protected by Pathfinder. These ships being Melbourne Star, Waimarama, Santa Elisa, Dorset, and Rochester Castle, And behind these were the Ohio and Ledbury. And behind them were the Port Chalmers and the destroyer Penn. Lastly was the Brisbane Star, but she had set her own course closer to the coast. Which almost brings us up to speed, as the waiting E-boats will have to deal with the warship group as they were the first to make contact. Which means the Manchester, covered last time, was not the first target of the E-boats. At 12:30 a.m., now August 14th, the warship's group radar picked up the waiting E-boats, which was when MS-556 and her companion started up their engines and went in fast. As they were to the north of the warships, the British vessels, along with their charges, turned to port to try to comb the coming threat, i.e., by turning into the approaching torpedoes, they lessened the amount of ship exposed. Meanwhile, all defenders, escorts, and merchant fired every gun they had to port. The E-boats laid smoke and retreated, only to return a few minutes later and try again. This time, they bravely stayed with the British warships, and a running battle developed, which went on until past the Kelabia light. By the time it was all over, the E-boats were out of torpedoes, their tracks covering this part of the Mediterranean. But in the end, no warships or merchants were hit. However, Italian radio traffic seems to indicate that while they suffered damage, no E-boats were lost either. The Italians decided that attacking the head was not a recipe for a long life, so slunk away and again decided to wait for a less threatening target. Though the Italians would dominate this night's actions, the Germans got involved with E-boat S-59. Waiting at a point about 5 miles north-northeast of the tip of the Cape Bon Peninsula, or Good Cape, or in Arabic, Ras At-Taib, Oberlieutenant Zerzi Albert Muller reported in launching two torpedoes that hit and set aflame a 15,000-ton tanker. However, no attacks were reported by the British or merchant ships to match this. And bringing us back up to the end of the last episode, 2 minutes later, at 1:04 a.m., again now August 14th, when the head of the convoy, i.e. the warships, were just past Kelabia itself, is when E-boats MS-16 and MS-22 made their attack and during their second attempt, hit the as-yet undamaged cruiser, HMS Manchester. But before this moment, practically every merchant crewman was pleading with his captain or master for permission to take out those lights with their guns. But as Tunisia was neutral, this could not be allowed. Still, the captains realized at this moment, those lights were serving the enemy. Going back to the doomed Manchester, her sudden damage and stoppage forced the Almeria Likes and the Glenorchy following behind her to take evasive action. The Almeria Likes moved away from the coast further out to sea, whereas the Glenorchy, captained by Mr. Skelling, went on to continue its search for the cruiser Kenya and the relative safety she could provide. Behind them was the Wamarama, and because of that, her crew did not see the sudden change in course of the ships ahead, so just missed ramming into the Manchester by mere yards. If not going to hard to port, she would have sustained damage that might not have been recoverable. Fortunately, she missed the warship and found an escort an hour later. 37 minutes after the Manchester was attacked by the E-boats, now 1:40 a.m., the destroyer Pathfinder, who always seemed to be in the right place at the right time, came upon the stricken Manchester. Commander Gibbs of the Pathfinder pulled in close to the wounded ship, but told the three ships that he had been escorting, the Melbourne Star, Dorset, and Rochester Castle, to continue on. The merchant ships did so, but not enthusiastically, and made sure to stay south of the minefields. As we have seen, the Pathfinder took on some of Manchester's crew, but then sped off to find her charges, who, it must be said, were thinking or fearing as individual ships, not as a convoy. By the time the Pathfinder found and passed the Melbourne Star, her captain, McFarlane, told Commander Gibbs that he could not keep up with the destroyer, and yet he had already left the other two supply ships behind himself. The Melbourne Star's damage not only affected her speed, but also caused sparks to exit its exhaust, letting all around, including the enemy, know of its location. It was a risk, but repairs could not be effected at this moment. The Melbourne Star continued on. As for the Pathfinder, she saw evidence of fighting up ahead, so went that way. This left Captain McFarlane and his crew of the Melbourne to worry over what was in their holds, namely 1,350 tons of high-octane spirit, 700 tons of kerosene, and 1,450 tons of high-explosive shell, along with heavy oil. What a torpedo from an E-boat could do with that. Meanwhile, the two other vessels that the Melbourne Star had left behind were dealing with their own threat. At 1:13 a.m., so soon after they had left the damaged Manchester, the crew of the Rochester Castle spotted an E-boat. This was probably MS-26, but when the crewmen spotted the E-boat, it's most likely that the smaller Italian vessel had spotted them first. True enough, in fact, the E-boat had already fired off a torpedo. The Rochester turning into the threat, again to reduce her exposure, but the torpedo was already there, hitting near the number 3 hold and creating a hole 25 by 18 feet. Now, the merchant ship had already sustained damage from earlier air attacks. Now the hold flooded immediately. Still, she managed at 13 knots. The captain made a mental note that the torpedo had also destroyed 2 lifeboats, should they need to escape in the future. Again, the Rochester moved on, but she was well down by the head. Close by and witnessing all this was the cargo vessel Dorset, led by Captain Jack Tuckett. Leave it to the zany Italian crewmen to cross the Dorset's path in celebration of their victory. Captain Tuckett tried to take advantage of this by literally running over the E-boat as it passed in front of him, but its speed and maneuverability served it well. The E-boat was unharmed, and the night was still young. At 1:50 a.m., the leading groups of warships, now a bit south of Calabia, was picked up by E-boat MS-31, led by Captain Calvani. In theory, the Glenorchy was behind the warships and just behind the Almeria Likes, so thought herself safe. She should have been safe, as the warship's plans was to attract first any who might come their way. Further, the darkness added a layer of protection, though in a passive way. As long as that held, she should be safe. But as MS-31 rushed in, now joined by MS-26, and about to pick a target, suddenly a light, whether from a lighthouse or another ship, made the cargo ship known to Calvani. Waiting until he was 700 meters, or 765 yards from the target, MS-31 launched 2 torpedoes, hitting the Glenorchy on her port side. A nearby destroyer fired on MS-31, but she got away, disappearing into the darkness. Just before 2 a.m., the Glenorchy came to a stop as her engine room was flooded, and all the lifeboats on the port side were now shattered. Not surprisingly, panic set in. Some men jumped overboard, fearing the fires would soon reach the stored aviation fuel, while others lowered the starboard side lifeboats before being ordered to. Clearly, all was lost, so Captain Leslie ordered abandon ship. Now that the word was given, Third Mate Mr. R.M. Simon gathered the ship's secrets, documents, and books, shoved them into a weighted bag, and threw them overboard. Next, he ran around the ship to check for injuries. Miraculously, there were no deaths. Captain Leslie then told Simon to get everyone off. But as Simon got into a boat, led by Second Mate Skelling, they both realized that Captain Leslie was not joining them. They looked up and spotted him looking down at them. They pleaded for the captain to join them, but he would not. When First Mate Mr. Haney in another lifeboat asked, "Where's the captain?" he was told that the man had decided to stay behind. Nothing doing, Haney grabbed the oars and started back to the Glenorchy. The captain was coming with them, whether he liked it or not. But then Haney had to stop and pick up three men who had jumped in just after the explosion. By the time they were squared away, he couldn't see his ship anymore. Captain Leslie had gone down with his ship. And as far as anyone knows, he was the last Navy merchant captain to do so during the war. The complement of the Glenorchy, including 25 passengers, rowed to shore, but not before MS-31 came alongside and took First Mate Haney and eight other men. The rest would end up spending time with men of the HMS Manchester and MV Clanfergusson. Captain Bassini of E-boat MS-26, seeing the success of Captain Cavani of MS-31, wanted his own success. So he sped up to catch up to the ships that had been left free to move on. At 2 a.m., just minutes after the attack that took out the Glenorchy, Captain Bassini, now 7 miles south of Kelabia, spotted and was spotted in return by a steamer and a destroyer. The destroyer immediately threw up star shells and started firing, as did the merchant vessel. But as Bassini was determined to have his own victory, he ordered MS-26 to dodge and weave through the approaching bullets. Yet the Allied response was enough to force MS-26 to speed around the two ships. She had approached north of her targets, now approaching again, but this time from the starboard side, all the while firing her own machine guns. But just before MS-26 went by the merchant ship, Bassini spotted another enemy warship. He believed it was a cruiser, which had to demand his attention. So he sent two torpedoes at her. This was at 2:20 a.m. and claimed that both had struck true. The British records, however, do not support this. Now, never let it be said that a Sicilian, or Italians in general, cannot be brave, certainly when death is on the line. But 3-1 odds? That's madness. Hence, Bassini put in a course to the west to make for the coast. But the destroyer was right behind her. And which destroyer was this? The Pathfinder, of course. One officer on the Pathfinder later wrote, "We put every gun that would bear 4-inch pom-poms and Oerlikons on her, along with their 44-inch searchlight. But that's when Bassini put up smoke and disappeared." Yet Commander Gibbs was not going to let this stop him. While still at full speed, the Pathfinder charged right into the smoke. If the E-boat had been playing some trick and had spotted or slowed down in any way, she would have been rammed. Fortunately, the small crew Bassini had kept his vessel maxed out. Now through the smoke, the searchlight relocated the smaller vessel, and once again, all guns that could fire did fire, which forced Bassini to throw up more smoke. Once again, the Pathfinder barreled through, but by the time they relocated the E-boat, she was safely away within an Axis minefield, where the Italians knew where the floating death traps were, but the British did not. And getting a message that a new attack had just gotten underway, the Pathfinder turned around and raced away. All this fighting got the attention of two more E-boats, MS-25 and 23. But as the pedestal ships were already in action mode and on the lookout, these E-boats were not able to get close enough to be a real threat. Not to worry, there were other E-boats still waiting their turn. Meanwhile, Captain Calvani of MS-31 didn't simply fade away. He tracked the main convoy force and kept his superiors updated on its location. But at 3:15 a.m., MS-31, with two other E-boats, having reached their operational range, turned north and headed for home. Soon after, the convoy was come upon again by yet another group of E-boats, this time MS-552, Captain Parasso, and MS-554, Captain Caucago. The cruiser Kenya laid into the approaching threats, trying to protect the Santa Elisa and Wairangi. But as many bullets had left the Kenya, one of the E-boats, they both fired a torpedo at the same time, struck the Wairangi. Captain Gordon of his now damaged ship wrote down the results. A torpedo struck between the number 3 tank and the cofferdam. That's a purposefully empty space to stop two liquids from mixing. Then the ship listed to port. The engine room and the number 3 hold were filled rapidly. The engines were stopped and emergency lighting came on. Lastly, the number 4 lifeboat was missing. While the crew fought the flooding with pumps, the gunners fought the E-boats with their weapons. Again, every gun that could be fired was. The Wairangi put out an SOS, which convinced the Italians that she was as good as gone. Time would tell. During this attack, the Ameria Likes had also been hit. She was behind everyone else, so a tempting target for the E-boats coming from port. Ahead of her was the destroyer Somali, but in front of her was the TSDS ship, or two-speed destroyer sweep, that conducted sweeps for mines ahead of the merchant ships. The TSDS ship, as did all the ships, military and merchant, had numerous lookouts around all of the ship, but after 4 days of being at their post, practically living there, their concentration and reflexes had been dulled. Thus was MS-554 able to get to within 550 yards before attacking. Later, the British would learn that MS-554 had launched not one torpedo, but two, so confident of her success, while MS-552 had only launched one torpedo, being a bit further behind. The result for the Ameria Likes was a hole near the number 1 hold on the port side. And in that hold were bombs for Malta. But however it happened, or in this case, did not happen, there was no cascading series of explosions, as there had been on the Clan Ferguson, which doomed her. Still, the Italians believed she was done for and reported it so. As to the extent of the damage, that was impossible to tell, as the bow went down low and the incoming water prevented anyone from getting too close. And thinking of the horrid scenes of the Clan Ferguson, Master William Henderson, born in Britain but now living in Texas, gave the order to abandon ship. It should come as no surprise that what happened next was confused, rushed, and possibly against Admiral Seyfried's orders. The Ameria Likes had not been a happy ship ever since Pedestal had gotten underway. The British liaison officer, Lieutenant Commander Hugh Marshall, wrote down his impression just before the convoy reached the Mediterranean. They were a mixture, just labeled American. To me, they did not seem to realize properly that there was a war on, let alone that they were in it. He goes on to say that this crew of 51 men, older than the average merchant sailor, complained about everything, especially the quality and quantity of their food. Meanwhile, with the abandoned ship order given, the British gunners and few passengers who had their own lifeboat began to lower theirs, which is when everyone on that lifeboat realized none of them had ever rowed before. Chaos now mixed with panic, whereas the American manned lifeboats, having experience, made for the Pathfinder, again, everywhere, at once. But Commander Gibbs had had more than enough of the Americans. He yelled at them to return to their ship, given it was still afloat, and given Seyfried's orders that no ship is to be scuttled if she is capable of steaming and there is no immediate risk of capture. As that was the case, Gibbs laid into the crew. He later recorded the following. The ship appeared to be perfectly all right. I persuaded her company to return to her and endeavor to steam her to Malta, not exactly true, more like a positive British spin on the events. Master William Henderson agreed to go back and evaluate the ship, but only three officers would go with him, and did so grudgingly. The rest sat in their lifeboats, as Gibbs would be damned if they were getting on his ship. One of the men who went back with Henderson was Commander Hugh Marshall. They rowed to the ship, examined her, and rowed back to Gibbs. Marshall told Gibbs that the ship's engines were intact, but due to the damage, maintaining any kind of speed was impossible. This, combined with the fact that her crew absolutely refused to get back aboard, forced Gibbs to relent. The smaller party rowed back to the Amerie Alikes to place scuttling charges, which went off, but it seems that the ship was more determined than her crew. She would not go down, which caused Gibbs to think about reconsidering his decision about leaving the ship behind, but now that the charges had detonated, it was a lost cause. Only at 9:30 a.m., after much soul-searching, given Admiral Seyfert's orders, did Gibbs allow the Amerie's crew to come aboard. Could they have made a go of it on the American vessel? Who can say? But as the bard said, nothing can come of nothing. Eventually, the cargo vessel would disappear, keeping it out of the hands of the enemy. Back to when the Amerie Alikes was first attacked, behind her was the MV Dorset, a cargo ship. She had been trailing the destroyer Penn, but soon they had drifted from each other. Now alone, the crew of the Dorset soon saw flashes up ahead. Clearly, an intense fight was going on, and they received a radio message to be on the lookout for E-boats. Dorset's master, Jack Tuckett, said something along the lines of, "Forget this," as he decided that following the other ships, as they were clearly being engaged, was not the way to go. So he steered a course further away from the Tunisian shore and figured that this more direct route would let him catch up to at least one escort by morning. Of course, this way would have him and his traveling through known enemy minefields, but obviously the other way forward would invite sure danger. And yet, at 3:30 a.m. and just under 30 miles off Kelabia Point, the Dorset hit two mines, or rather, ran into two mines, in her attempt to avoid enemy vessels. Tuckett wrote that the ship seemed to be operating normally, but he himself thought her plates had to be compromised. And if that weren't enough, the two detonations got the attention of a German E-boat that soon was on the Dorset's port side. Gunner John Waters lit into the smaller vessel until his gun jammed. As the E-boat was only 20 yards away, he threw his torch or flashlight at it. The E-boat and her crew were unharmed by his attempt. Just as the Dorset's crew believed their end had come, another explosion was seen in the distance. It was the Amerie Alikes. She was about to go through her own hell, just described, but however it happened, this was not the end of the Dorset. And again, borrowing from the bard, "O fortune, fortune, all men call thee fickle." But it was Benjamin Franklin who said, "Fortune is as fickle as she's fair." Thus was Amerie Alikes doomed, but Dorset saved by her mysterious ways. The German E-boat turned away. Greetings, everyone, from Central Virginia. So I just wanted to thank some more people who have donated and who have become members. Again, thank you. You'll never know how much this means to me. So I just want to say thank you. So if you do donate in the future, if you want, please tell me where you live, and I'll mention it. Some of you did, some of you didn't. Completely up to you. So here's some more people that have donated. And again, thank you. Michael Peck, James Griffith, Christopher Massar, who is from Finland, and he also became a member. So Chris, if I may, there are 215 membership episodes waiting for you. I hope you enjoy them. There's also Edward Dry, Matthew Evans, who's from Leicester, UK, who holds the rank of LTM, long-term member. I'll come up with a medal. I'm sure I can come up with something. But Matthew, thank you very much. Tim Agnew, Darren Edmonds, Burnham Enterprises, but I think his name is Roy. So Roy, I think you sent me an email. I am very jealous of your job. So get me a job there, or let me know when you do another World War II thing with the trains. That would be amazing. And I think you're in Pennsylvania roughly, so that would be cool. Michael Thomas, Stephen Robinson, Ryan Klein, and Doug Judd. You, sir, keep being amazing. Thank you very much. And Stephen Gale. And there are more names, but again, I didn't want to do this for like a couple of minutes, so I'll just do a couple each time. And those who became members, let's see, Burton Whited from Dallas Center, Iowa. Andrew Stegenga from Woodstock, Georgia. Thank you, Andrew. And lastly, as far as membership, Desmond Murphy from Londonderry, Northern Ireland. Again, just thank you very much, and I'll put out some more names next time. Again, we're getting very close. They're less than 200 miles from Malta. Of course, they're losing ships left and right, but we will have to wait and see how it turns out. Again, thank you to everyone. Spring is here. Summer is coming soon. I hope you enjoy it, and you will hear from us soon. Take care, everyone.